I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times.
When it comes to a time when our country can't make aluminum and steel, and somebody said it before, and I will tell you, you almost don't have much of a country. Because without steel and aluminum, your country's not the same. So steel and aluminum, we'll see a lot of good things happen. We're going to have new jobs popping up. We're going to have much more vibrant companies. And then the rest is going to be up to management to make them truly great. If you could ever make U.S. steel like it used to be, we'd be very happy. And I actually think it's possible.
That was President Trump back in March in a lightly edited clip announcing tariffs on steel and aluminum imported from the EU, Mexico, and China. The countries were given a several-month reprieve to make room for negotiations. Yesterday, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross announced time's up, and this morning those tariffs are now officially in place. These are U.S. allies, mind you, and the administration's justification for the new tariffs is national security. Meanwhile, U.S. negotiators have been meeting with Chinese officials about trade and tariffs. The president caused confusion and controversy when he said he wanted to help the Chinese telecommunications company ZTE that had been sanctioned by the United States, saying too many jobs in China are being lost. Candidate Trump made criticizing trade deals a centerpiece of his campaign and complained about China stealing American jobs. President Trump said recently, trade wars are good and easy to win. Well, time will tell. Today on Radio Times, trade, tariffs, and Trump. Joining us by telephone is David Lynch. He's global economics correspondent for The Washington Post, covering trade and globalization. David Lynch, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much.
Also with us is Mary Lovely. She's a professor of economics at Syracuse University, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and she joins us from their studios. Mary Lovely, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Mary, let me begin with you. Are we now in a trade war with our allies?
It certainly seems that way. The announcement of the imposition of the tariffs, I think, has left little doubt, although with this administration, we're never quite sure what will happen next, but that the tariffs will be imposed, and the recipients of the tariffs are getting ready to retaliate.
In fact, they're talking about tariffs on American products like bourbon and gin, peanut butter, Harley Davidson. I read about food. I even read about lamps. So the war is on, Mary?
Looks like it. We're having a lot of different products. The actual list is a little less important than the intent, I think, which is to really try to inflict some damage and send a message to the U.S. that our allies are not happy about this and see it as a political risk for them, certainly an economic risk, and kind of a wake-up call for us.
David, let me turn to you. We're talking about a 25% tariff on steel, 10% on aluminum. Do we know how much that would drive up the cost of those metals?
Well, I think you've already seen an impact in the domestic market. I was meeting with some manufacturers this morning who were saying the domestic prices they're paying are already up 30-40%. And, you know, the administration, Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross in particular, have disparaged the idea that these tariffs will really make much of a difference to American consumers or American companies. And I think you can make that argument at the aggregate level, at the macroeconomic level, and you can make it the way Secretary Ross has made it, pointing to the cost of a single can of beer or a can of soup. But when you talk to individual manufacturers who have often very specialized needs for a particular type of steel, many of those types of steel just literally are not produced in the United States, and they have to be acquired from a limited number of producers worldwide. And if the price goes up because of this import tax, there's no escaping it. And that price will filter down through these companies. Some of the smaller ones may have to close, may have to lay people off. And that will be less visible, I think, than some of the new steel mills that the president will be pointing to.
Well, are there certain products that you're talking about, whether it's automobiles or washing machines or other things that are made out of either aluminum or steel, David?
Sure. Some of them are parts, you know, fuel injectors in an automobile or industrial equipment that's sort of not the final stage of a product that a consumer would buy, but, you know, a part that goes into a machine that's then used by a company to make another product. And so, you know, the administration has portrayed many of their tariffs, particularly the ones against China, as targeted in a way to minimize the impact on Americans. But I think most economists, and I defer to Mary on this, think the impact is going to be larger and more painful than the administration acknowledges.
Mary, the ball is in your court. Who will be most affected? And I guess if we can put it in terms of, I hate to do this, but winners or losers, as you see it today, who wins, who loses?
Well, the tariffs, particularly those that have been announced under Section 301, which is the action against China, will very clearly fall on the supply chains of multinationals operating in the United States, many of which are American firms. That's kind of a hidden tax on products for consumers. They might not see that, part of a washing machine or a lawnmower or something else goes up. They'll just see a slight increase in the overall price. So I certainly agree that these are kind of stealth taxes on consumers. However, when we look at the accumulation right now between all of the different actions that the Trump administration has announced or is investigating, we have almost $400 billion worth of imports that are going to be subject to very high taxes. Some of those, like on washing machines and on autos, will be felt by the consumer. So kind of the thunder's rolling in. It hasn't hit yet, but I think consumers will start to wake up to the impact of these tariffs.
Mary, if I'm a steel worker, am I happy today?
I think you probably are. However, it really depends on where some of the steel workers actually depend on imported steel for further processing. So it really depends on where you are in the industry. And that's a very small section of the American labor force. So, yeah, there may be some happy people out there, but they're really very few in number.
Well, David, I think what we're learning is looking at products that we think might be American is that they often, you know, cross a border, whether it's, let's say, Mexico or Canada, multiple times. I believe, I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but many cars made in this country, many of the parts come from our neighboring countries and things pass back and forth over our borders. Can you speak to that?
Sure. No, that's absolutely true. We've spent most of the last 30 years, certainly since the end of the Cold War, disaggregating production and spreading supply chains in North America, in particular, treating North America as a single market, not individual national markets of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And we've done that on a broader scale with production in East Asia, particularly in technology products. And what the administration's trying to do is turn the clock back on that, and they're making no secret about it. One of the president's trade advisors, one of his closest advisors, Peter Navarro, in the White House, has made no secret of the fact that they want to bring these supply chains back home. And I think the people who are worried about that don't think it's possible to do overnight and don't think that the jobs that have gone elsewhere are going to come back, certainly in the same number. Some of them might, but mostly they'll come back as industrial robots.
Mary, let me go back to you. And much has been made of the fact is that if we're talking about Canada, Mexico, and the EU, these are our allies. And the use of this law goes back to 1962, the national security reasons for imposing tariffs. Does that make sense to you?
It makes absolutely no sense, and it's really quite a cynical move on the part of the Trump administration. And many people feel that rather than enhancing national security, it actually hurts national security because it has the effect of undermining international law international law does allow for exceptions, ways that we can violate our previous trade commitments to our trading partners, such as an emergency or a war or preparing for war. But clearly, none of these actions actually meet that test. And so this begins to erode the foundation, the rules-based foundation for trade, and certainly weakens our ability to go with them, say, for an action in the Middle East or for another event that arises. So we're undermining international law. We're losing good faith and goodwill with our closest allies and basically being viewed increasingly as an untrustworthy partner.
Let me play something that Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said yesterday. He was speaking from Ottawa about this decision to levy tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum. This piece is just lightly edited, and let's give it a listen.
That Canada could be considered a national security threat to the United States is inconceivable. These tariffs are an affront to the long-standing security partnership between Canada and the United States, and in particular, an affront to the thousands of Canadians who have fought and died alongside their American brothers in arms.
David, that's a very emotional Prime Minister of Canada talking about this personal relationship between our two countries. Is that now at risk?
I think certainly it's at risk in a way we haven't seen in my lifetime.
Really? Wow. I don't know how old you are, but I'm assuming...
Well, older than I wish I were, I guess. I thought the Prime Minister... I watched the press conference yesterday online, and I thought the Prime Minister was speaking in as controlled a fashion as was possible publicly to get across just how insulted and angered I think our allies are by the use of this particular provision, because the idea, I think even for the layman, the idea that Canada or the European Union or Mexico could be regarded as a threat to the security of this country, one of the great benefits and privileges that the United States has enjoyed for centuries is the fact that we have friendly neighbors in North America, which has made it a lot easier for us to be the superpower that we've been traditionally. We haven't had to really worry, with the exception, of course, of the illegal immigration issue. We haven't had the sorts of border concerns that a lot of other states have had. And the idea that, in the time of war, that if we needed steel from a Canadian mill, we couldn't get it when many of our fighter jets are built with Canadian steel, strikes folks in Canada and elsewhere as ridiculous and insulting.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation talking about the tariffs announced yesterday, a 25% levy on steel, 10% on aluminum. It started at midnight last night or 12:01 this morning, talking with David Lynch and Mary Lovely. Much to discuss after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mary Lovely. She's a professor of economics at Syracuse University. She's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Also with us, David Lynch. He's global economics correspondent for The Washington Post, covering trade and globalization. We're talking about trade and tariffs and the president's decision yesterday to impose a 25% tariff on steel, 10% tariff on aluminum, coming from our neighbors to the north and south, and also from the European Union. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think this means for you? Mary, let me go back to you and go back to what we heard from Prime Minister Trudeau. Besides raising tariffs on U.S. goods imported into our neighbor to the north, what else can a country like Canada do?
Well, Canada is in a particularly vulnerable position because of the deep integration of our two economies, as David spoke about before. They're in the hot seat on steel. They're also very vulnerable on auto tariffs. Our two production systems are so deeply intertwined that it's very hard for the government to even have estimates of how much Canadian content there is in a vehicle.
Really?
Yes. And so it's going to be a real hardship if we do impose tariffs on their passenger cars and auto parts. We actually don't even know how we would do it. Again, it goes back to the point you made before, which is that the parts go back and forth across the border multiple times. So, you know, we've spent the last 30 years, getting rid of this system that will require us to count this and tax this, and now all of a sudden we might have to create a system where it's not taxed multiple times, and it's just going to be a mess. Mm. So there's not even an idea for how this will be implemented. As far as other things that Canada can do to either retaliate or protect itself, I think it's already beginning to look for other partners and negotiating free trade agreements outside of North America. Most importantly, we saw the CPTPP, which is the
CPT.
Follow-up.
Okay, I don't even know what that is. What does that mean, Mary?
Well, it's really the current version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, of course, was negotiated with the United States as one of the partners. President Trump announced that we were not going to be part of that. There were further negotiations among the remaining countries, and Canada is fully committed to this now. And it will be a free trade agreement involving many countries in the Pacific region. And I think this is an important sign that Canada is seeking to protect itself from being blocked to from the U.S. market. And most people see that as very unfortunate. Instead of building a strong partnership where we could really try to fix some of the legitimate, the real problems and legitimate concerns that businesses have in terms of market access into China, or other problems with the WTO in terms of getting disputes settled, we're engaged in really a very backward-looking types of policies that are going to not save jobs, actually destroy jobs. We talked a little bit before about steel jobs. We didn't talk about all the jobs that are going to be lost in all the steel-using industries. The same thing with autos.
David, let me read a couple of comments. A tweet from Jim. He says, who gets the tariff money and how is it used? A tariff is a tax. I mean, I'm assuming we can use those words interchangeably. Who gets the tariff money?
That's right. Tariff's just a fancy word for an import tax. It's collected by customs and goes to the government. There was a time back in the 19th century, in fact, and matter of fact, I think President Trump mentioned this in one of his campaign speeches, where the government's primary source of revenue was import tariffs. It was only in 1913, I think, that the import income tax was introduced. And there's a lot about his overall vision of trade policy and approach to it that really harkens back to a 19th century approach, and that's best seen in his enthusiasm for tariffs.
Well, let me ask you, David, President Hoover's tariffs were one of the causes of the Great Depression. Should we be worried about some kind of depression or certainly impact on our own U.S. economy, broadly speaking, or even the global economy?
Yeah, you're referring there, of course, to the famous Smoot-Hawley tariff, 1930. And although I think that's often sort of conflated with the causes of the Great Depression, my recollection, and again, I'll defer on economic history to the economist, my recollection is that aggravated a bad situation. I think U.S. imports in the first couple of years after Smoot-Hawley dropped by something like 40%. I think Doug Irwin of Dartmouth, who's written a quite lengthy history of U.S. trade policy, concluded about a quarter of that decline was was caused by the tariff, we're a long way from that. I think, you know, it's often useful, and you know, in the journalism business, sometimes we get ahead of ourselves with whipping up fears of trade war. I do think we're at the shots fired stage of the trade war. We're not at a Great Depression, Smoot-Hawley stage of it, but I think, and I think that would, nobody's anticipating that, but, you know, as Mary said earlier, given some of the sharp changes in administration policy and the lack of a traditional policy development process in this White House, it's hard to rule anything out.
Well, and Mary, I mean, there it was Wilbur Ross, he's the Commerce Secretary. He made the announcement about these tariffs. But we've got Kudlow, we've got Mnuchin, we've got Lighthizer. There are a number of other people within the administration all involved in some degree of economic policy. And it seems that there is a, maybe war is too strong a word, inside the administration, but certainly some pretty profound disagreements. How does that, I guess, impact whatever decisions are being made?
Well, we did see conflict between the group that was sent to Beijing. Kind of embarrassingly, they were fighting among themselves in front of the Chinese delegation.
Right.
But it looks right now as if the hawks, the trade war hawks, are ascendant. So, again, we're reading tea leaves. I think David mentioned something very important, which is the lack of a traditional policy formation process in the administration. And this really, this lack of a process and the use of the knowledge that's already embedded in the federal, the executive branch, leads to policies that seem as if the administration doesn't even really understand how our economy works today.
Wow.
A good example is the tariffs that are being threatened against China. They seem unaware of how much these will hurt American businesses and businesses operating in the United States and how much they will be passed through to American consumers. So, again, we think of it as 20th century policies being used in a way that makes us think that they, you know, really do think the economy is the way it was 50 years ago instead of the way it is today.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Mary Lovely. She's a professor of economics at Syracuse University. Again, a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. David Lynch, global economics correspondent for The Washington Post. He covers trade and globalization. And we're talking about what a lot of people are talking about today. Yesterday, the announcement that the United States was imposing stiff tariffs on the European Union, on Canada and Mexico, on the steel and aluminum that gets imported into the United States. You can join us again. Any questions or comments that you might have, we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Is NAFTA still going on, David Lynch, or does this put a knife into the not maybe not the heart, but the kidney of NAFTA?
Well, if not a knife, it's maybe come up lame a little bit. The negotiations that started on an overhaul, a modernization of the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico started last August. Initially, the administration had a very ambitious schedule. They wanted to be done by the end of the year. I'm not sure anybody took that entirely seriously. Then the next objective was, well, let's finish it by the end of March. March came and went. Then it was mid-May, maybe late May, all with an aim towards getting this done in time to meet a legally mandated calendar for notifying Congress and going through various wickets to get a vote on a new agreement by the end of this year under the current Congress, because, of course, depending on what happens in the midterm elections in November, could be a very different political landscape in January. But it's now become increasingly clear that there's very little hope. It may, in fact, be impossible to get NAFTA done this year. That raises all sorts of questions about what type of agreement it'll be and the prospects for getting it through a potentially Democratic-controlled House. And certainly stands in sharp contrast to the president's often repeated claims during the campaign and subsequently that getting these changes that he seeks in trade policy and in the trade agreements would be very quick and could be done, you know, in no time at all.
Let me read something, and this underscores, Mary, something that you said. This is editorial opinion page coming from the Wall Street Journal, generally supportive of the president's economic policies. I'll just quote a couple of sentences. They write, "So much for Donald Trump as genius dealmaker. We are supposed to believe his tariff threats are a clever negotiation strategy, but on Thursday he revealed he's merely an old-fashioned protectionist. His decision to slap tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Europe, Canada, and Mexico will hurt the U.S. economy, his own foreign policy, and perhaps Republicans in November." Strong words coming, Mary, from the Wall Street Journal. Who else, I guess, and the Koch brothers, my understanding, they're not happy about this. Others that we think of as really supportive of the president and certainly of Republican policies.
Well, it's interesting to think about how unusual the president's policies lately have been. There is a intent, or maybe it's not unintentional, to replace government decision, the market decisions, with government decisions. So here, with a 25% tax on autos, the government is telling me what kind of car that I can buy. I think even more kind of hidden is in the steel and aluminum case, companies that are seeking an exemption, say because they do not have a good domestic source of the particular type of steel that they use, as David mentioned earlier, they have to fill out a detailed form revealing everything about their sourcing behavior, the nature of their inputs, the chemical composition of the steel that they use. Mm-hmm. This goes to a government bureaucrat who decides if they're going to be able to buy that or if they're going to have to wait to have a domestic supplier. I mean, I frankly am not sure why the Wall Street Journal hasn't been shouting from the, you know, top of the roof before this.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Warren, wondering whether this will be the beginning of what he calls ugly inflation. David, do you see this showing up in a higher inflation rate in this country, or is that too soon to tell?
Well, I think it's certainly going to put upward pressure on prices, whether it'll be dramatic or not. My sense and what I've seen from economists so far is I don't think there's an expectation of any sort of sharp uptick, but this is one more rock being added to the basket, if you will, at a time when the Fed is already tightening policy, raising interest rates, and withdrawing some of the extraordinary support that it provided to the economy during the years after the financial crisis. And, you know, the good news is that you do want prices to come up a little bit. That's a sign of a healthy economy that's growing steadily as we are now. But you don't want it to get out of hand. And we're not in any immediate danger of that, but we've certainly got the Fed tightening, now a lot of tariffs being put on, questions about oil supply and the like. And, you know, depending on what else happens down the line, you could start to worry. But I wouldn't say an immediate risk.
Mary, an email from Kristen who asked, could there be more nefarious reasons for tariffs on our allies? Are we pushing our allies? Are we pushing out our allies to do more business with our adversaries? Can we see it that way?
I don't see it that way. I mean, there may be some people who see it that way. I don't see it that way. I don't think that these, say, in the steel or the auto imports, you're going to see a big increase in steel from, I'm not sure who she's thinking about particularly, but if it's Russia and China, we're not going to see a big increase in steel from those areas. Same thing with autos. It really is very hard to see a systematic vision here. That's one of probably the most difficult things for us to deal with. It's very hard to anticipate what will happen next and see any patterns. And that, I think, is deeply troubling for businesses who are looking to invest. We had this tremendous tax cut, very large tax cut, historic proportions. And yet, are we going to get the boost in terms of investment when the investment environment is so uncertain?
David, I'm going to ask you to explain the decision involving the Chinese telecommunications company ZTE. This company had really violated American sanctions on selling advanced technology to Iran and to North Korea. The American intelligence agencies identified this company as a security risk. The president said he wanted to essentially help this company because it would create jobs in China. Is it possible to understand the president's thinking on this?
It is, but it is, at the same time you understand it, I think you have to recognize it as very unusual. I think the ZTE case is very interesting for all the reasons you've laid out. It's also striking to me because it reflects the way that the president looks at a broad range of issues. He doesn't distinguish in the way I think the traditional chief executives have between sort of core national security concerns, genuine national security concerns like ZTE, and the rest of the bargaining chips that are on the table over market access for agriculture or industrial products or autos or what have you. I think when the president looks at relations with China, it's like a poker player looking at the table. There are red chips and white chips and blue chips, but they're all just chips. And so I think from his perspective, he feels like, you know, look, Chinese President Xi Jinping called me and asked me to do something on this. This is a favor I can give him. I don't particularly care whether the punishment for ZTE was what it was laid down to be in April or a little bit softer than that. If by making it softer and doing Xi Jinping a favor, that enables him to give me something on cutting auto tariffs so Ford or somebody can sell more cars in China, it's all the same. And so I think that to me is the significance. It shows that the president's approach is quite different. He blurs the line between national security and economic security. It's really all one and the same.
And that's David Lynch of the Washington Post, along with Mary Lovely from Syracuse University, talking about trade, tariffs, and Trump. And we got lots of people that want to join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and if just joining us, talking with David Lynch of the Washington Post, Mary Lovely of Syracuse University about the most recent news involving tariffs on steel and aluminum, imports coming from Europe, coming from Mexico and Canada, also talking about negotiations having to do with trade and tariffs involving China. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Lots of comments, radiotimes at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mary, I do want to give you a chance to respond to this whole question about ZTE. And we should say these were sanctions on Iran and North Korea, and we certainly know how the president feels about Iran, but somehow ZTE allowed to essentially get away with violating some of these sanctions. Questions about whether this benefited a Trump family or not. Let me get Dan to join our conversation. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just like a sort of reality check. It seems that whenever this administration, particularly the president, proposes sanctions or tariffs, the talk disappears after a week or two, and it seems there's been some concession made, whether, I don't know if it's lobbying or not, in the case of ZTE and also in the case of a Chinese government-owned bank giving a $500 million loan to the Trump Organization for the Lido project in Indonesia, and they get trademarks in return as well as this loan. And now ZTE he wants them to be in the clear, among other things. So I want to pick up on something David Lynch said, that there is some sort of concession made. He was making the point the concession was to our government. I think it's to the Trump family. Am I nuts?
Are you nuts? Well, we can't answer that, Dan, but it's a good question. Let me put it to Mary Lovely. And just to underscore what Dan said, there's some question about whether some trademarks awarded by China were given to Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter, and about the ZTE decision and these trademarks. I don't know if it's possible to connect the dots, but it certainly raises some questions.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. We don't have a smoking gun to say this is a quid pro quo, but the mere appearance of, a deal that's being done for the personal benefit of the president's family is very negative for U.S. stature abroad as well as for our own democracy. So it's really a tragic outcome and certainly erodes trust of people like Dan. I did want to, even if the trademark or the loan was not a pro quo for the leniency with ZTE, I wanted to go back to something David said, which is about the poker chips, red, white, and blue. I think that it's not only that Trump views the entire international economic and international security table as flat. That is, he doesn't differentiate between what's national security and what's economic. It's all transactional. I think he doesn't even understand the difference in the value of a red chip versus a white chip. So, for example, with the Section 301 tariffs that were threatening China, you know, what are we going to get out of this? Are we going to get, a slight increase in sales of soybeans or liquid natural gas? What about the longer-term issues that are on the table with China about technology transfer, about market access for American companies, about how they're going to use industrial policy in the future in a way that allows market access for international companies? These are really important issues. They seem to have no understanding of the depth of Chinese policies in these areas, and really an inability to ask for clear outcomes and then monitor them. So again, it just seems like this traditional policy formation process has been short-circuited, and we have someone who's kind of treating all of these outcomes as if they're the same instead of going for really important long-term changes for the U.S.
David, let me pick up on that. What does China want, and do they have the upper hand in their negotiations with the United States?
Well, I think China wants the whole thing to go away, and I think they feel like they've got a good chance of pulling that off, in part going back to something Mary said earlier. The U.S. side of this has been so divided and so visibly divided that it plays into China's hands, because the Chinese know what they're about. They have a very experienced set of folks who come to these negotiations. They're all reading from the same script because they have a coherent message and a more of a long-term vision. And the irony is that, you know, unlike yesterday's actions against our allies, what the president's trying to do with China has broad support, broad bipartisan support politically, and broad support in the American business community, because there are a whole range of Chinese trade practices that can legitimately be questioned or described as unfair to foreign companies that the U.S. has complained about for years and has seen only grudging change in return. But the question, as you look at what the administration's trying, is whether the president has the attention span and the understanding of the issues and the commitment to hold the line on this, or whether he's going to, in the end, settle for a quick deal just to have a win to brag about on the campaign trail this fall.
Let me read some more comments. Does Congress have any role in managing these tariffs? David, can I toss that back to you? What role does Congress play, if any?
Well, Congress constitutionally has all the authority in the world. The issue, though, is that in the past they've delegated a fair bit of this to the president, and you know, the president and his trade advisor, chief trade negotiator Robert Lighthizer, who's a veteran attorney, very well respected, knows his brief, have driven a Mack truck through every loophole in the process, and we've seen that on yesterday's tariffs. Those no one had ever really thought, before the Trump administration, that they could, the national security exception in the 1962 law could be used in that way. But legally, they could force the issue, and they did. If Congress, yesterday we heard a lot of complaints from Capitol Hill, and often from most of the Republican Party, including the Senate Finance Chairman Orrin Hatch, Ben Sasse from Nebraska, Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, Lots of criticism of the president's action, because the Trump vision of trade policy is diametrically opposed to the modern Republican Party's free trade orientation, which has generally been backed by the corporate community. But if any of these lawmakers wanted to do something tangible to restrain the president, they could do it. They could, the authority that Congress has given the president, Congress could take away. But there's no sign yet that they're willing to have that kind of confrontation.
I was thinking about something John Boehner said yesterday, a former Speaker of the House, that the Republican Party has become the Trump Party.
I think that's largely true. I think, the transformation over the last couple of years politically, since Mr. Trump rode that escalator in Trump Tower, has been remarkable. And I think what it's exposed is the divide between the Republican base, the voters, and the political party in Washington, this free trade orientation, pro-globalization, if you will, that had traditionally been the party's stance, was really increasingly at odds with the party's base, who have suffered from a lot of the same processes. And what's been interesting politically is to notice the similarities between the Trump wing of the Republican Party and the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party. They're very close on these issues.
Interesting. Let me read a couple of more comments here. A tweet: how does Trump's personal gain correlate with these global market decisions? Can we ever really know the extent of his personal gain on each decision he makes? And I mean, at this point, we don't have access to his tax returns, so we probably won't know that now. A question from John from Phoenixville: will the tariffs impact corporations that move their companies overseas for cheap labor? Mary, can I toss that to you? Do you see companies seeing these high tariffs that they might move to where cheaper labor is?
Well, I mean, I think that they're partly a response to the fact that companies have moved parts of their production process overseas. David talked about Peter Navarro's intent to bring these parts of the production chain home. That's not going to happen, largely. What may happen, for example, with the tariffs on imports coming from China, which are largely parts and capital goods, so they're not consumer goods, at least in the things that the Trump administration is targeting with the tariffs, that is going to raise costs for American companies. They may be able to pass those costs on to American consumers, but the taxes don't apply anywhere else in the world, and so they won't be able to sell at the higher price outside. So they'll have to move more production outside of the United States to be able to serve their international customers. So, you know, this really, because of the way production networks are set up today and not 50 years ago, the responses will be complicated, but overall will be very negative, will be negative for American employment.
Let me read an email from Philip from Ardmore. He says, with this tariff, we risk seeing retaliatory tariffs on our agricultural products. Will this not affect states that represent the president's loyal base? Will they know? Will they care? David, could that affect the more sort of rural states in the middle of the country?
There's no question that it will affect those states. And the president has been made aware of this. We saw it in the NAFTA talks, where at one point when he was threatening to pull out of NAFTA entirely, Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue brought a chart to the White House that showed in very vivid terms what the impact would be on Trump voters out in the heartland. And that did get the president's attention and temporarily at least caused him to back off. But in recent days, our reporting here at the Post has shown that he's just fundamentally become impatient with the entire process. These trade negotiations can often take a lot of time. You can imagine how laborious the process might be of trying to work out diplomatic arrangements with various trading partners. And the president just has heard the arguments, and basically his attitude is, well, you know, what are we supposed to do? Just let all these other countries take advantage of us? We've got to do something. And so he defaults to action.
Mary, is there a place for tariffs? I mean, we're talking about tariffs as if they're a terrible thing. But is there a place for tariffs in a global marketplace?
Well, we have a place for tariffs under WTO, World Trade Organization rules. We use tariffs, for example, when we feel that a foreign government is unfairly subsidizing an industry. So, for example, we already have tariffs on Chinese steel because we believe that the Chinese are unfairly subsidizing their steel producers. We also can use tariffs if we feel that a country is unfairly dumping goods below cost into our market. So there is a role for tariffs. The misconception is, are tariffs a job-creating machine? And, you know, not only just economic theory, but experience in the business world shows it's not. It protects an industry which is probably weak to begin with. It does not encourage innovation. It keeps people working in jobs for which there is no future. The hard part in the U.S. is that when we have, when we see this type of change, we don't offer people much help in terms of moving into areas that might be growing. Not only people, but their communities. And we've seen, as David mentioned, that that has led to this split between sort of the more moderate, traditional Republican view on trade and what we believe is motivating some of the Trump base.
Almost out of time here, David. The unemployment rate in this country is I forget. And there were some numbers today. Yesterday was 3.9%. It might be even be less than that. And certainly, the president talks about trade deficits, whether it's with China or with the EU. Is there a connection between these two?
Well, I think the Peter Navarro school of thought would say yes. Other economists say the mainstream economist view is that trade deficits reflect broader economic forces like national savings rates and those sorts of things. But I'm glad you mentioned trade deficits, because this is an important point, and it's the fundamental concern that animates the president's entire vision of trade. Is he's focused on countries like China, with whom the U.S. runs a substantial trade deficit.
Right.
Last year, $375 billion in goods trade. The problem is, because of the way that trade deficits are counted, it's a little bit like using a broken thermometer to tell you what the weather is outside. There's all sorts of reasons to look at that trade deficit and say it doesn't really mean anything, or certainly not nearly as much as the president would think. And the Apple iPhone is the example that's always used, because if a phone is imported to the United States from China, $600 phone, that counts as $600 into our trade deficit. But most of the value of that phone was generated by the United States, by the designers, the marketers, etc. The Chinese factory workers who stitched it together at the end only account for a fraction of the value, and yet the entire $600 goes on the Chinese side of the ledger.
Huh. Well, we're going to end on that note. That was really interesting, David Lynch. David, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Happy to do it.
And he's global economics correspondent for The Washington Post, covering trade and globalization. Mary Lovely, thank you for joining us as well.
You're welcome.
And she's a professor of economics at Syracuse University, a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, joining us from their studios. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our newsletter. That's it for today's Radio Times. Diana Martinez, our engineer. The show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.